وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب مبين صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And you are not engaged in any affair, nor do you recite concerning it any portion of the Quran, nor do you do any work, but we are witnesses over you when you enter into it. And there does not lie concealed from your Lord the weight of an atom in the earth or in the heaven, nor anything less than that, nor greater, but it is in a clear book.
Good day to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio. Good to have you with us. It's 12 noon here in Tehran, and I'm your host for the next hour. We'll start this hour's programs with our news bulletin. They will be followed by Bookshelf. The program introduces authentic and reputable Islamic books that have been written or translated into English. And we round up this hour's programs with our radio productions feature. Stay with us for this hour.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Reminder of our top stories, Iran wraps the European Troika for ignoring Tehran's reasonable plan on the country's nuclear program, urging the UN Security Council to intervene. Israeli forces press ahead with their brutal aggression against Gaza City, killing more Palestinians and forcefully displacing thousands of civilians. And Hamas strongly condemns US's veto of a UN Security Council resolution at a Gaza ceasefire, saying it proves Washington's full complicity in the Israeli genocide. Hello, I'm Bahman Roy, and this is News. Iran's foreign minister says he has presented a reasonable and actionable plan to the three European parties to the 2015 nuclear agreement to avert an unnecessary and avoidable crisis in the coming days. Abbas Araghchi made the comments ahead of a Security Council meeting to discuss the activation of the agreement's so-called snapback mechanism. He, however, added that instead of engagement on the substance of the plan, the Troika is making a litany of excuses, including the farcical claim that the Iranian Foreign Ministry does not represent the entire political establishment. Arashi said, in reality, the Troika's diplomatic apparatus is the one that is out of commission, and it is high time for the UN Security Council to intervene and choose diplomacy over confrontation. He stressed that Iran has already done its part by signing a new cooperation agreement with the UN Nuclear Agency and offering a balanced proposal which addresses genuine concerns and is mutually beneficial. Arashi concluded by saying that there is still a way forward, but Iran cannot be the sole responsible actor. Larry Johnson, a former CIA analyst, joined us earlier to discuss what's going on behind the scene of Europe's nuclear allegations against Iran. Here's what he had to say.
Europe never complied with the JCPOA. They signed on to it, and they did not lift the sanctions, as was required by the JCPOA. When I first heard that Iran was engaging the IAEA, I was a little shocked by that because of the role that I believe the IAEA played in spying on Iran and passing intelligence to Israel that was used to target Iranian scientists. That's a level of perfidy and betrayal that I think is unacceptable. However, having gone back and reread the JCPOA agreement and the issue involving snapback sanctions, I understand why Iran is pursuing. Iran's trying to do everything by the book. Iran is, some might argue, foolishly trying to play by the rules of the so-called international rules-based order. The problem with that is that the West, they apply the rules only as it favors them. They don't apply them equitably. And so what they're doing here is playing a game.
Thursday was the fourth day of the annual General Conference of the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, in Vienna. The Iranian delegation attending the conference is pushing for a resolution on prohibition of attacks on nuclear facilities. Several countries have urged Iran to postpone their resolution. Dieter Reinisch reports from Vienna.
The Iranian delegation attending the IAEA General Conference has held an event shedding light on the country's resolution that reaffirms the prohibition of attacks on nuclear facilities. The Venezuelan envoy to Vienna chaired the event.
Welcome to this side event organized by the Islamic Republic of Iran to address the issue of the attacks against nuclear sites and facilities, a serious threat to international peace and security, and to address its implications for the non-proliferation regime.
The event was addressed by some of the IAEA states which co-sponsored it, such as China, Pakistan and South Africa.
All the members, they should side with one side, which is preserving the NPT regime and IAEA safeguard regime. So let's work together to try to stand on the right side of history.
Given the grave consequences for population and the environment of any attacks on nuclear facilities, in our view, the space for attacks on nuclear facilities is non-existent.
Meanwhile, Russia called on Britain, France and Germany, collectively known as the E3, to stop the snapback mechanism. The E3 triggered the mechanism in early August that would restore UN Security Council sanctions against Iran. The final deadline for a decision is September 27. The Russian envoy also criticized the US and Israel for attacking Iranian nuclear sites in June.
What Israel and the United States did was the biggest blow to the IAEA safeguards system. The E3 should also stop the implementation of snapback mechanism in New York. Triggering snapback was illegal, politically irrelevant and counterproductive.
Iran's permanent representative to the IAEA reiterated the illegality of the U.S. and Israeli attacks on the Iranian nuclear sites.
The attack on the Iran's nuclear facilities under the IAEA safeguard is unprecedented in the history of the agency. This is the first time while the facility being under full scope safeguards of the agency and inspected on a daily basis. We had inspectors in all facilities almost all the time, and facilities been attacked by one non-party to the NPT, and the other one, unfortunately, the depository of the NPT, which is the United States.
The U.S. delegation is meanwhile putting pressure on IAEA member states, particularly in the Western and North African regions, not to support the Iranian resolution.
In 1977, Amendments 1 and 2 of the Geneva Convention prohibited attacks and threats on nuclear facilities. But the U.S. are threatening to cut bilateral ties with countries if the Iranian resolution passes. A reckless behavior putting global security at risk. Dieter Reinisch, Vienna.
Hamas has strongly condemned Washington's veto of another UN Security Council resolution that called for immediate, unconditional and permanent ceasefire in Gaza. Hamas said blocking the draft resolution proved the United States' blatant complicity and full partnership in the Israeli genocide of Palestinians. It added that the veto is also a green light to Israel to continue killing and starving Gazans and press ahead with its criminal aggression against Gaza City. The resolution was drafted by the 10 non-permanent members of the Security Council and was backed by 14 of its 15 members. It demanded that Israel immediately and unconditionally lift all restrictions on the entry of humanitarian aid into Gaza. This is the sixth time that the United States has vetoed a UN Security Council resolution on the Gaza ceasefire. The U.S.'s decision to veto another UN Security Council resolution to halt the Gaza genocide drew strong backlash from other members of the Council. Palestine's ambassador condemned the veto as both regrettable and painful.
This draft resolution represents the bare minimum that humanity, legality, and morality dictate. It is deeply regrettable and painful that it has been blocked, preventing the Security Council from playing its rightful role in the face of these atrocities and to protect civilians in the face of genocide. It is regrettable that you, the custodians of the maintenance of International Peace and Security Council, were unable to act in that direction.
Mansour said Palestinians had hoped the Security Council would help end the war on Gaza, but the U.S.'s veto left them angry, frustrated, and deeply disappointed. He added that the pain and anguish endured daily by the Palestinians in Gaza should move any human being. Along the same line, Russia's ambassador Vasily Nebenzia slammed the U.S. veto as a blow to diplomacy. He said the Security Council has been paralyzed by the will, or rather the absence of the will, of a single delegation. China's representative Fu Kong also expressed deep disappointment over the veto, stressing that once again the Council's attempt to act was forcefully blocked by the U.S. Political commentator Eric Wahlberg joined us earlier. He says the world needs a new United Nations with new regulations, especially regarding the right of veto.
It's not a surprise. U.S. is supporting Israel. U.S. Israel is what I call it. They're like Siamese twins. They are conjoined. I don't know if it's blackmail on the part of Israel of Trump, although so much of his Epstein files have already been exposed. But even there, it doesn't seem to matter in American politics. It's really smoke and mirrors is the kind of politics. I think what will have to happen is the U.S. and Israel will have to be excluded from the UN. I think it's really, we have to construct the new UN, which is what Putin and Xi of China and Modi of India, they want to build a new UN without this veto of the U.S. So I think that that's what we're really looking for. First of all, expel Israel. And once Israel is expelled, then if it's still Trump, Trump will pull out of the UN himself.
The Israeli regime presses ahead with its ground offensive against Gaza City, which has so far killed many Palestinians and forcefully displaced thousands of others. Three civilians were killed in airstrikes on Gaza City's Al-Nasr and Al-Rimal areas, while three others lost their lives in an airstrike west of the city. Nearly a dozen Palestinians were also killed in combined air and artillery strikes on the Atafar neighborhood and the Ashati refugee camp west of Gaza City. Death and injuries were also reported after Israeli forces opened fire on displaced people sheltering in tents in the Almawasi area of the southern city of Khan Yunus. Medical sources reported 4 new deaths from malnutrition, raising the total toll to 435, and that includes 147 children. Nearly 10 aid seekers were also killed by Israeli forces on Thursday. The death toll from the Israeli genocide now exceeds 65,000, with over 165,900 others injured. Our Gaza correspondent Muti Abu Masaba says the Palestinian death toll is more likely to rise in Gaza as Israeli forces carry out more airstrikes on residential buildings.
Over the past couple of hours, the Israeli occupation forces renewed their brutal attacks against various parts of the city, and they were concentrated in a shattered refugee camp. The last one targeted a makeshift tent of the Palestinian people. Definitely more Palestinian civilians were confirmed wounded and injured as a consequence of the attack. Meanwhile, the Israeli warplanes launched another wave and cascade of the brutal Israeli strikes targeting more residential buildings. The current situation is desperate for the Palestinian people, as you have just mentioned, that more than 400,000 Palestinian civilians are still trapped and they are still exposed to those brutal and non-stop genocidal attacks. And so this reflects how catastrophic and disastrous the situation is for those Palestinian civilians, while the Israeli forces are still scaling up their attacks against those Palestinian people who are absolutely devastated with these constant attacks. So what the Israeli occupation forces are doing to the Palestinian people on the ground is, as you know, complicating the situation more and more for the Palestinian people. Even being displaced and evacuating Gaza City is not an easy mission for those Palestinians. It is a journey fraught with risk, fraught with difficulties, with more pain, more misery for those Palestinian people, particularly when it comes to the elderly people, when it comes to the children, the women. We are talking about, as you know, tens of thousands of the Palestinian pregnant women who are forced right now to evacuate on their bare feet from Gaza City to the northern, to the southern parts of the strip.
Hundreds of UN staff have gathered in the Swiss city of Geneva to protest the targeting of humanitarian workers by the Israeli regime in Gaza. The UN staff carried placards and laid white roses next to the memorial plaque to pay tribute to hundreds of aid workers killed in Gaza. Figures reveal that over 500 aid workers have been killed in the Gaza war since October 2023.
We have never seen such a high number of deaths. It's true that in the past, we have lost humanitarian colleagues in various operations, and we have always protested against that, in line with humanitarian law. But what we are seeing today is on a scale never seen before. We have never had more than 370 colleagues killed in this way in a single war, a single conflict. First, we expect our colleagues to be protected, so that we can be protected during the exercise of our functions. We also expect our independence to be protected, so that we can continue to perform and carry out our mandate and our work. And we also expect, of course, because we are working for peace, that leaders do everything they can to accelerate and enable peace to return.
The Yemeni army says it has carried out new retaliatory strikes against Israeli targets in the occupied Palestinian territories in support of Gaza.
The missile force of the Yemeni armed forces conducted a qualitative strike with a Palestine 2 hypersonic ballistic missile, hitting a sensitive Israeli military site in the occupied Jaffa region. Meanwhile, the UAV unit carried out two separate operations. The first employed three drones against multiple targets in the Umm al-Rush area, and the second used a single drone to strike a sensitive site in Beersheba. All operations achieved their objectives.
Sari stated that the operations were carried out in retaliation for the ongoing Israeli genocide against the Palestinians in Gaza and the regime's aggression against Yemen. He said the strikes forced millions of Zionist settlers to flee to shelters and led to the closure of the airspace over the occupied Palestine. Sari vowed that the Yemeni armed forces will continue to target the Umm al-Rush area. He also indicated that Yemen will continue its operations against Israel until the aggression against Gaza ends and the siege of the territory is lifted. Activist and political commentator Hussein al-Bukhaiti joined us earlier. He says the Yemeni army's ability to penetrate the occupied territories proves that U.S.-Israeli attacks on the country have been ineffective.
Yet again, the Yemeni armed force have shown the Zionist state of Israel that their attack against sites in occupied Palestine will not stop, and they will continue, as a spokesperson of Yemeni army has insisted today in his statement. The today attack, as you mentioned, used two hypersonic ballistic missiles and four drones. Those drones, actually, they were not the Israeli air defense were not able to shoot down those drones. That's why I believe since the attack a few weeks ago on Ramon airport south of occupied Palestine with a drone, this means that Yemeni, I believe that they are using new type of drones the Israeli air defense is unable to search or to find those drones. That's why, as Israeli has announced, one of the drones has hit a hotel, as they said, in Eilat. And this is exactly what the Yemeni armed force have said today, that all Eilat and all occupied Palestine will continue to be a target. And I believe that meanwhile, when Yemeni actually are expanding their attack with more drones or with more hypersonic ballistic missiles, send as well a clear message to the Zionists and as well to the United States and any other country that's supporting Israel, that Yemeni blockade will not stop, and that their attack against Yemen, which mainly targeted the ports and civilian area in Yemen, is not actually affecting.
Iran has reiterated its full support for the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Syria, calling any attempt to impose external agendas or fragment the country unacceptable. Iran's UN ambassador was addressing a Security Council meeting on Syria. Amir Saeed Iravani expressed concern about agendas or demands for federalization of Syria, saying such aspirations could fuel fragmentation and renewed conflict in the country. He added that Iran will continue to support the Syrian people and their efforts towards restoring peace and stability, reconstruction and national reconciliation. Iravani stressed that lasting peace and stability in Syria can only be achieved through a Syrian-owned and Syrian-led political process free from foreign interference and coercion. He also condemned Israel's acts of aggression against Syria as flagrant violations of international law and UN Charter, urging the Security Council not to remain silent on those violations. And with that, we bring this news bulletin to an end. Thank you so much for staying with us.
7. Very much appreciated.
We come to you, and O God, knowing that thou art our only King.
You are listening to the program Bookshelf on Iran Radio with Sheikh Yasser, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته dear listeners, welcome to another episode of Bookshelf with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. The book that we would like to introduce to our dear listeners in this episode is titled Humbleness, the Head of Goodness and the Basis of Worshipping. So as we know, Islam as a religion emphasizes moral traits and good moral traits, what is known in the science of akhlaq as the fada'il, that those virtues and merits that a person inculcates within themselves. However, it is not just a mere inculcation where it is done once or twice. No, it is something that is done so often that it becomes a malakah, or what is known in contemporary psychology as a trait. It becomes a habit. It becomes something that when we come across a situation where this particular trait or this particular facet of our being should be shown, it comes about instantly. It is not something that we have to think about. So this is the point of akhlaq, and this is what we should aim for, humbleness. Now, however, this particular book is not going to do that for us. It may teach us about it. It may tell us certain things regarding it, its definition, its description, so on and so forth. But the actual inculcation and the actual implementing of this particular ethical trait and this moral virtue comes back to us, that we are the ones who have to do it. And it comes with all other moral traits and all other moral virtues, that the only way it can become a trait and a malakah in us is if we practice upon it constantly. This is something when it comes to everything. And therefore we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that by the right of the Rasul sallallahu alayhi wa sallam and by the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, that these particular moral traits are something that we can first of all learn, implement, and for them to become a malakah and become a trait in us. And for all the vices and evils that we have to be removed from us, inshallah. So inshallah, in our next segment, we will be going a bit further into this book and some of the chapters of this book, but for more information about this book, inshallah. So please stay tuned.
Why do we read books in the first place? What are books good for?
We read books because we don't want to reinvent the wheel, if you will.
We'd better take advantage of human cultural and intellectual heritage, particularly related to our daily activities, such as our physical, mental, spiritual, or even religious health.
We can't ignore the past thoughts and experiences. To do so, we need to boost our bookshelf.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. So the book that we have introduced to our dear listeners in this episode was titled Humbleness, the Head of Goodness and the Basis of Worshipping, or should be the basis of worship. This book was compiled by the Department of Intellectual and Cultural Affairs of the Abbasiyya, or the Hazrat Abbas alayhi salam holy shrine, located in the city of Karbala. So one of the blessings that has happened with the fall of Saddam is that the Husseini and the Abbasi shrines have gotten certain organizations that deal with cultural and educational and academic affairs. And in this way, certain books have been published by them, especially in Farsi and in Arabic, but most in Arabic, and there's obviously a need for this to be done. So for the brothers and sisters who want more information about these books, they can visit the website www.alkafil.net, and most of these books are available for download for free on these websites. This particular book was translated by Burak Abdul Hassan, and again, as we mentioned, it was published by this particular Intellectual and Cultural Affairs Department of the Abbas alayhi salam holy shrine. So this particular book, or a small booklet as we mentioned, deals with the concept of humbleness. and it deals with from different approaches, different means, different manners. For example, the book begins with a prelude on the concept of humbleness and so on and so forth. Then it goes into the best and worst kinds of humbleness. There's also a chapter that let us share together the advantages of humbleness. So it speaks about the definition of it, what it actually is. And is the leecha included in the domain of humbleness? Now, I don't actually know what leecha means in this particular thing, because I mentioned this one of the first translations of this particular book. Doesn't mean it's a very good translation, but inshallah, it will benefit the reader who goes about it. Some of humbling results, meaning some of the results that a person who's humble will achieve and will get, some of the benefits of it. The Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam is the peak of humbleness. This is another chapter that is written in here, and so on and so forth. Humbleness in the attributes of the great and the function of the prophets, and so on and so forth. So this is a very small booklet. And it continues, for example, those who walk on the ground in humbleness, and so on and so forth. So this is the book in front of us. It again is a book that aims to give us practical advice and practical manners and a definition of this particular ethical trait. And for us, hopefully, not only to read about it, to know about it, but to practice upon it, as I mentioned in our first segment. So inshallah, for the benefit of our dear listeners, we will read a small portion of this book in our next segment. So please stay tuned.
Sacred texts we have received to help us understand where we came from and where we are going as a human race are most rich in helping us find our direction. They narrate stories of our past, but where have they brought us? Where are their messages now? Are we the people of belief, or have we become the people of the boxes? Is there wisdom trapped in our bookshelves? Bookshelves, bookshelves, bookshelves.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. The book that we have introduced to our dear listeners was titled Humbleness, a translation done by the Department of Intellectual and Cultural Affairs of the Abbas alayhi salam, Holy Shrine. So the place that we would like to read from is titled Ahlul Bayt, Peace Be Upon Them, as the Peak of Humbleness. Again, understand that this translation was an early translation. Obviously, it needs some work, but we will, again, keep true to the translation that is in front of us. We adduce to you here some of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them, virtues, i.e. we introduce to you here, and the unique and typical example of humbleness. The Prophet, peace of Allah and his blessings be upon him and his pure progeny, was the most humble one at that time. And if he entered a house, he would sit at the end of the assembly, that is, wherever there was a seat, a place, he would just sit. He would not bother to go and find a place or go look somewhere in the front or ask someone to get up for him. No, wherever there was place, he would just sit. And at home, he used to perform the required family tasks, such as milking the sheep, patching his clothes, mending his shoe, serving himself, carrying his goods from the market, sitting with the poor, and feeding them. So basically, the Nabi sallallahu alayhi wa sallam was not somebody who wanted to be served. He wanted to serve. So this is a very important trait that we should learn, that we should not be of those who think that we are higher than others. The Nabi is the highest individual in the eyes of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, yet he wants to serve everybody. He, again, the Nabi sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, peace of Allah and his blessing be upon him and his progeny, would not stand up until the other person does. He would not force anybody to leave. He would not force anybody to become uncomfortable. But he would always do that. He starts salam, greeting whoever he comes across, and extends his hands first when shaking hands with his companions. That is, the Nabi sallallahu alayhi wa sallam would always greet first, would never wait for it. It was his culture and it was his trait that he would always greet first because of the merits of greeting first and of the virtues of greeting first. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that the tradition and the sunnah of the Nabi is something we attach ourselves to, and it is a means for us to, by which we gain proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and salvation on the Day of Judgment. Inshallah, until next time. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program Bookshelf on Iran Radio with Sheikh Yasser, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. Bazaar.
If you look around, nearly every object you see is made of raw material extracted from a mine. Basically, if you can't grow it, you have to mine it. The extraction of minerals, metals, and fuels from the ground is one of humankind's oldest industries. Never more than now has society been so dependent on greater variety and larger volumes of mined products. So it's no surprise that mining fuels our modern world and makes economies grow. Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar. I'm your host Alireza Ikhtiarzadeh, and this week we will be exploring the mining industry while shining the spotlight on the machinery used in this sector. We wanted to see what types of machines are used and who is actively manufacturing them. Plus, we wanted to understand why the mining sector is crucial to the national economy and how manufacturers contribute to its progress. So, let's roll out the show. Our quest for answers led us to Shahrud city in Semnan province, where we visited a company specializing in manufacturing various mining machines. With nearly 20 years of experience, this knowledge-based company is active in a host of fields. It conducts research, development, and production of equipment needed in various industries. That being said, it also manufactures a variety of excavating, drilling, trenching, and digging machines. The life of any product begins in the design room. This company has researched and developed these machines and has perfected their performance. Optimizing the machine size, speed, and power to carry out tasks has also reduced the expenses related to projects where these machines are used. These machines can be used in agriculture and road maintenance, among other medium-scale construction projects. Most materials needed to make these machines can be purchased inside Iran. Steel sheets, gears, wires, and whatever else is required to build the machine can be domestically found. And if a design requires a particular part, this company can make its own molds to create the parts. You might find it interesting that these machines are currently imported, as there is a high demand among mining companies for equipment. So indigenizing the production of mining machines has been a big step towards supporting this sector. Another benefit to local production is it saves the country millions by cutting back on imports. The beating heart of this knowledge-based company is its research and development department. Here is where all the magic happens. This area employs some of the most talented and experienced specialists to research, design products, and optimize existing ones. But that's not all. The research and development department also studies future projects. This company also dabbles in making equipment used to harness renewable energy. This company not only uses its own expert staff, but also stays up to date on the latest knowledge by maintaining links with the Industrial University of Shahrud. It collaborates with academic institutions and exchanges knowledge with them too. Furthermore, this knowledge firm also uses capacities and resources made available by Semnon Tech Park. Among its services, it offers the execution of projects through contracting. For example, it has used its machines to complete piping and installation of telecommunications manholes for intercity networks. Another example is carving drainage systems in agricultural fields using its trenchers. Over the years, this company has made a variety of award-winning machines, such as drilling machines equipped with fiber optic lights. Moreover, this company has invented 6 products that have been internationally patented. This knowledge-based manufacturer has never stopped eyeing the future and has plans to expand its production units and product portfolio in the coming years. The company we just mentioned is part of the puzzle that helps Iran's mining sector thrive. It is one of Iran's key industries, as the country is one of the top 10 mineral-rich nations globally. Roughly 7% of global mineral reserves can be found in Iran, making it one of the most important mineral producers in the world. Numbers from Iran's Trade Promotion Organization show that last year the sector saw a growth in exports. Government officials, however, say export figures could still be much higher. Furthermore, efforts have been placed on encouraging research and production in knowledge-based firms to increase specialized production, such as mining machines, in the market. And here is where knowledge-based companies play a big role. Okay, time for me to take a little break from here and divert your attention to a report that I made earlier in the week. Hey everyone, welcome to another special feature of Bazaar. Today we are discussing energy production, specifically electricity production through gas turbines and some of the problems that come with it. So, in different times of the year, mainly during the summer, we get sporadic blackouts at peak hours, at one of the peak hours, let's say around 12 at noon until 4 to 5 p.m. Because we cannot store electricity, electricity production must always match electricity consumption. But because of the temperature during these hours, during this time of the year, during the summer, temperature, high temperatures in particular, negatively affect electricity production through gas turbines. So first we're going to take a look at, well, why that is and how gas turbines work. But and also, we believe that we have found a solution at Sharif Innovation Center in one of the companies that has made that solution, and we're going to check that out too. Why do high temperatures negatively affect the performance of a gas turbine? Well, bear with me as I try to explain how a gas turbine works through this prototype that they have here. This is the prototype of the device that would be used at scale. This is not at scale. So this is, imagine this is the gas turbine. How it works is that it sucks air through these air ducts, and the temperature of that air is very important. I'm going to get back to that. The air goes through a compressor here. The compressor compresses the air, which we would need the compressed air for the combustion chamber. A combustion chamber essentially makes this work exactly like a plane engine or a car engine. A car engine is slightly different because the movement that it produces is linear, whereas the plane engine has rotary movement. So that's exactly what it is like because it produces rotary movement. So in the combustion chamber, we add a certain type of gas to the compressed air, and then a little spark creates an explosion, and the explosion, the high pressure air, would then spin our turbines. And the turbines, which have movement in them, are connected to a generator, and the generator's job is to turn movement into electricity, which goes through the power grid and then gets to whoever needs it. Now, the thing here, the important thing about the air temperature is that we need ideal conditions, ideally, for the machine to work at peak performance. And that ideal condition is at sea level 15 degrees Celsius. So the air, ideally, is 15 degrees Celsius, but we don't get that kind of temperature in a lot of places, especially in a hot and dry climate. So we have a couple of options to alleviate that problem. Number one, the inefficient option is to work the compressor a lot more, which would use a lot more energy, but that's not even the issue. The issue is that there's a lot easier of a way. So what they have found at TEPCO company is that they have instead tried to use an ice storage unit to work as a thermal storage compartment, because the thermal storage capacity of ice is 100 times more than that of the water. So here they create ice essentially at midnight until the morning when no one is using the power and the air is colder, because that is what happens. The difference between temperatures during the day and temperatures during the night in dry climates is pretty massive. So it's a lot easier to create the ice during that time. So they do that so that in the morning or at noon during peak hours, 12 p.m. to like 4 or 5 p.m., they have the ice to cool the water that is in the storage, and the cooled water goes through a radiator behind the air duct so that the air, the probably hot air that comes through the chamber, is cooled using the water that is in the ice storage compartment. That water cools the air down to like 15 degrees and gives us ideal conditions to work with. So the compressor doesn't need to work that hard. We get our ideal conditions through the ice storage unit. And that is how they are able to offset the amount of electricity that we would lose if we were to use the compressor a lot harder. And that's pretty much how a gas turbine works as well, but also this is the innovation here. A better way to cool the air and get a gas turbine to work at peak performance. There are other less efficient methods of cooling the water that comes through the chamber. Both of them are called evaporative cooling. The first type is done through a wet media, most likely a cooling pad that you see in water coolers everywhere. So how it works is that there is a lot of surface and they run water through it, and the air is going to go through this cooling pad. So as the air goes through the cooling pad, the water absorbs the heat from the air and evaporates. Evaporation is an endothermic procedure, which is heat absorbing, which means that the heat is absorbed from the air and transferred to the water, which evaporates, making the air that runs through the cooling pad a lot cooler. This is a rather wasteful method because, well, you're using water, because in the method that I showed you, you don't use water. The water is just circulated back into the system. This one, you use water, and it's just generally not that efficient. The other method is even more inefficient. You see it in a lot of places in like outdoors restaurants. They spray water through the air that is going to go through the chamber, and the extremely tiny water droplets absorb the heat from the air and evaporate as they are sprayed. This also absorbs heat from the air, and that is why when you go through the spray of water, you feel a cool breeze, because the air is a lot cooler, because its heat is transferred to the water molecules. So both of these methods are pretty inefficient, and I just wanted you to know about other methods that are used, but they are definitely more inefficient. And this chart is a demonstration of how our thermal storage system would perform in an actual 400 megawatt hour power plant system. When the ice is getting used during in midday, it bumps up the production by a difference of 60 megawatts in a regular 400 megawatt hour power plant. Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you for tuning in. It's bye for now.
Good day to all of our listeners from around the world. This is Iran Radio broadcasting from Tehran, and I'm your presenter for the next hour. We start off this hour's programs with Middle East Stream. The program analyzes the latest developments in occupied Palestine, Lebanon, and Syria. And we round up this hour's programs with insights into the Holy Quran. The program presents a short exegesis and explanation of the ayahs of the Holy Quran, and we round up this hour's programs with our varied radio productions feature. Stay with us for the next hour.
Midstream.
Tonight, we sit down with a Lebanese Member of Parliament for the Armenian Orthodox seat, part of the reformist bloc, Pola Yakubyan. As a descendant of Armenian survivors who escaped a historic genocide, Ms. Yakubyan brings a deeply personal perspective to today's crisis in Gaza, a collapse into what many now call genocide. Yet amid the grief unfolding there, she has taken a controversial stance, supporting the Lebanese government's move to disarm Hezbollah, a group many believe protects Lebanon from Zionist Israel's repeated violations. In this episode, we confront this paradox head-on. We explore how, in the face of escalating aggressions, not only in Lebanon, but across Syria, Iraq, Yemen, and even small Persian Gulf Arab states, she can advocate for dismantling Lebanon's only credible deterrent. Can she square this position with her ancestral legacy? And what does it say about Lebanon's future? Spola, thank you very much for your time and your contribution to our show on this day. I want to start with what's really important in the region at the moment. And I know that you yourself is a descendant of the Armenian genocide. So my condolences that extends through time for that genocide. And I know that you mention Gaza and say that it is a modern genocide. How do you see what's unfolding at the moment when the Zionist entity basically stunning the Palestinian people, leave all of Gaza City?
So thank you for having me. I'm going to speak in Arabic because I can see this is very, very tricky. I feel much more comfortable speaking in Arabic.
No problem.
And again, thank you for having me. I'm the daughter of a genocide survivor, not the granddaughter.
Thank you for clarifying that.
Yes, sure. And you said something as if there is a paradox or a contradiction between me defending the Armenian genocide and at the same time, you know, asking to disarm Hezbollah. These are not two opposing values at all.
We will talk extensively about that.
Okay.
But first,
you
first
give me the time to talk about
it. I want to begin with Gaza.
With Gaza.
At the moment,
yes.
Telling a 1.7 million population to leave the area. What do you think about that?
This is the craziest thing. It's so insane that no one could have imagined anything like that. But I mean, now we are in an era where everything is surreal, but the problem is that it's happening in reality.
There are no words to truly capture the massacres unfolding before the eyes of the entire world, nor the Arab and international impotence in stopping a criminal like Benjamin Netanyahu. Without a doubt, humanity has descended into a very dark abyss.
And despite seeing that and going through the horrors that we went through over the past almost 700 days in Lebanon and seeing what Zionist Israel was capable of doing, not only in Lebanon, which supposedly people say it was Lebanon's fault for poking the bear, but Syria never poked the bear, especially after the fall of Bashar al-Assad. Doha never ever poked the bear, and it was hit hard during this past week, and yet you want to see the arms of Hezbollah taken away. Why is that?
I demand that this armament of Hezbollah, not now, but from day one. It was clear to every Lebanese person that these weapons undermine the very project of state building in Lebanon.
They erode any possibility of building institutions, a secure country, and a place where all citizens can live in safety. We were told that those arms protect us, that they are Lebanon's strength. The events of the recent war have shown otherwise. Those weapons do not deter, and in no way do they protect. The tragedy of the latest war continues to unfold today, and Lebanon has borne the cost alone on behalf of all Arabs. 50 years of conflict, and Lebanon has paid the price by itself. The continued presence of arms in Hezbollah's hands is, without doubt, an invitation for Zionist Israel to persist in its occupation, its raids, its destruction, the razing of land, and the devastation of Lebanese infrastructure and livelihoods. Those weapons have failed to protect Hezbollah's own leadership, have not protected Lebanon, have not safeguarded Hezbollah's environment, and they have not empowered Lebanese citizens to defend themselves. On the contrary, they have invited increasing destruction. Today, we must all admit that handing those weapons over is the true source of strength Lebanon can rely upon. Whenever we tell Zionist Israel to withdraw and stop attacking Lebanon, the response is Hezbollah has weapons and will not give them up. That excuse must be removed. Lebanon must rebuild its institutions and its state. It must have a strong national army. Strengthening the army begins with dissolving all militias, starting with Hezbollah, and transferring every weapon to our national army, which should include the sons of our nation from all sects and regions.
This is a debate that is widely open in Lebanon, but there's an issue here where you started by saying all Lebanese people agree that, and then you continued. But if that was the case, you started by saying كل لبنانيين, by saying that,
I did not say that all Lebanese people agreed on disarming Hezbollah. No. There are those who are convinced the weapons should remain, or that they should be bargained with in exchange for some price.
So let's take that into consideration and think about the people who have lost everything and for the past 50 years have been losing and have been giving their own families, their own shops, their own businesses, their own lives. You know the entire story of it. But why not go ahead and make a referendum? Let the people say what they want to say.
In Lebanon, we have unfortunately never restored to a census or anything of the sort. But we do have a clear constitution. The Lebanese constitution does not speak of the existence of militias or arms outside the control of the security forces and the national army. What previous governments did was to legitimize Hezbollah's weapons through their ministerial statements. That no longer exists today, and there is no longer any legal or legitimate cover whatsoever for those arms. Our constitution is crystal clear. It speaks of gathering all weapons from the hands of every militia. The exception granted to Hezbollah in the early 1990s has expired. The time has come to turn our focus toward building a state in Lebanon. It is clear that with the existence of a state within a state and Hezbollah's arsenal, a proper state cannot be built, nor can a strong army. The two simply cannot coexist. Can you name a single country in the world that has both a militia and a national army, at the same time enjoys success, stability, and security? There is no such example anywhere on the face of the earth.
I would argue that there was something similar to what happened in Lebanon after the liberation, for example, like France, but they took over the government, and this never happened in Lebanon.
In France, there was a resistance during the German occupation, if that's what you are referring to. But once the state was restored, once they regained their land, there was no longer a militia nor anything of the sort.
Because they took over and they literally killed everyone who was part of the Nazi government. But in Lebanon, that never happened because it was integrated into the community. And as
you're making an analogy that I don't think applies to Lebanon.
I'm giving you an example, and you say it wouldn't work in Lebanon. And maybe other people could say that what you think is a pretext for Israel to come and attack us is not the case, for example, of Syria, that for 55 years, not even a bullet was fired at Zionist Israel, and they took more than 700 kilometers squared of Syria. Doha is in an economic and political alliance with Zionist Israel, and they were bombed. One of their police, I think, if I'm not mistaken, one Qatari national, was killed alongside with other four Palestinians as well. Added to that...
Are you trying to say that if the weapons are no longer in Hezbollah's hands today, Zionist Israel will be deterred from striking Lebanon?
And if the... I'm asking you, if there was a disarmament without arming the government, what do you think will happen?
Those weapons would be handed over to the Lebanese army and become a strength for all Lebanese, because they would be given to the national institution that unites Lebanese from all sects.
But Zionist Israel has been bombing the...